No.
Okay. We need to get, would you go get the bag?
Hello, everybody. My name's Louise, and I'm a recovering compulsive overeater. And let's take a deep breath and just kind of get organized and centered and relaxed. The agenda tells us that we're going to do this piece until 8 o'clock. That's okay, and I have 10 past 7, so is that... I haven't changed my watch to Seattle time, so I always have to double check. 10 past 7, so we have about 45 minutes. So, all right, thank you for coming back. Thank you for staying. I know some people had to go, and I know some of you have long drives ahead of you, so I appreciate you being here. We are going to talk in this session about steps 7 through 9. And so our big book... Our big book says, step 7, humbly asked him to remove our shortcomings. So step 6, we were entirely ready to have God remove these defects of character, and then we go into 7. And I had something really quite amazing happen at the meeting a week ago Wednesday at my home OA group. We were reading step 9 in the 12 and 12. And it says... To amend something means to change it. We complete our amends for our wrongful actions of the past by changing our actions in the future. This is especially important when making amends to ourselves and those people close to us whom we repeatedly harm by our patterns of behavior. The reason I read that in terms of step 7 and where it took such meaning for me is that, you know, we're really clear that we can't remove our defects of character. That's God's job. We humbly ask God to remove those defects of character. But what this says to me in step 9 is that I have a responsibility for my behavior. And so what I learned and what's true for me is that when I'm working the 7th step, I ask God to remove those defects of character, those thought patterns, those beliefs, those points of view that make me need to lie, that make me feel it's important to be totally independent. I've come to recognize in the last few years what a character defect independence is. I don't have any trouble asking the people in the rooms of OA to sponsor me or to take my phone calls or to listen to an inventory. But it rips me apart to ask somebody to come and help me with painting. Or changing the doors, the locks in my house, or, you know, there's something about it that I feel really, I find it really difficult to ask for that kind of physical help, even from my kids. They don't mind, but even from my kids. So what that reading says to me and what step 7 says to me, although it's encapsulated in a prayer and again kind of one or two paragraphs in the big book, is that I have to own my behavior. I heard an AA speaker at a roundup one time say, my job is not to throw more gas on the fire of that character defect. God will remove it, but I have to stop feeding the fire. And that to me made sense. I couldn't stop that need that I had to people please and to make you like me and to make myself seem bigger or better than I am by lying. I couldn't stop that need, but I could stop telling untruths and get honest to the best of my ability. You know, sometimes I didn't realize until well after the fact. But I had to start telling the truth. I had to stop abusing myself by not bathing. I had to stop abusing myself by not brushing my teeth, by not cleaning my makeup off at the end of the day, by not taking care of myself. And those are all part and parcel of some of my character defects, because the last thing I want to pay attention to is this physical being. I'll educate my mind and I'll work on my heart, but boy, working on my body was really slow to come. And so I had to figure that out. One of the things that I found out, I have some feet problems, and so I go regularly for pedicures. And it's really no big deal. I've had the same esthetician now. We were figuring it out the last time I was there. I've gone to the same woman once a month for about 12 years. Okay? And I just go. Because it's part of that business of accepting that I have to take action. If I want to have some self-respect, if I want to have a place, if I want to be in a place of appreciation of my body, I have to take care of it. And so I do. And one of my character defects was not taking care of myself. Anybody else in the room have that defect? Take care of your kids, your husband, your house, your dogs, and yourself is last on the list, right? And I just came to understand that that's just a character defect. It's just another element of how this illness keeps me sick. And so part of my recovery was not feeding that fire and starting to take care of. And so it's just part and parcel of the process. So join me, if you would, please, in the seventh step prayer, which in our book is on page 76, if you've got your big book there. And it says, "My Creator, I am willing that you should have all of me, good and bad. I pray that you now remove from me every single defect of character which stands in the way of my usefulness to you and my fellows. Grant me strength as I go out from here to do your bidding. Amen." Grant me strength as I go out from here to do your bidding. Which ties us back to the third step, right? 76. In the big book, yes, the seventh step prayer. It's in the second paragraph. And so, what I came to understand for many, many years, the seventh step was the cornerstone of my recovery. Because in asking God to remove my defects of character from me, I had to be aware of what they were, and I had to be willing to practice different behavior. So over the last year or two, I've been asking God to remove that negative tape that plays in my head. You know, that never-ending loop that just goes round and round. That it doesn't matter the circumstance, I'm not smart enough, I'm not pretty enough, I'm not thin enough, I'm not good enough. And as I start behaving in different ways, all of a sudden my life changes. I've done lots of studying in psychology, and I came across a brand of psychology some years ago, a model called cognitive psychology, and it very simply says that your thoughts control your life. And it says that it's interesting that it's as successful treating depression using talking and thinking as drugs. And I always kind of thought, well, no, my emotions are kind of sacrosanct, they're pure, they're what I feel, and that's real, and I'm not going to repress them. And it turned out I found out that was wrong. Emotions are really chemical reactions that happen in our brain that cause us to have a physiological response. And yes, emotions are a chemical reaction in our brain that cause a physiological response in our body. That's all they are. And guess what causes the chemical reaction? It's what we think. So if you change your thoughts, you change how you're feeling. That night, sitting in my car on the highway after my daughter's rehearsal party, when I finally got it together enough to say, what went right tonight? Right? I acted with grace and dignity. I talked to her dad. I had a good conversation. I had a good chat with my son. I had a wonderful conversation with the minister. I didn't drink anything, and I didn't eat anything that was on my food plan. As soon as I started focusing on what I had done right, all that negative stuff went away. And it was like this epiphany of joy and gratitude bubbled up and kind of flowered in me, and I was left with freedom. Now, I got to tell you, in the 7 years since, that kid still doesn't talk to me. You know, and she has a little girl that's two that I've never met. And you know what? That's not what I want, and it's not how I think it should be, and I don't deserve it. But I can stand here and cry about it, or I can stand here and be okay. Because it is what it is, what it is. If I get thinking, this isn't the way it should be, I didn't raise her to be that way, I didn't, you know, I don't deserve this. It's not right. It's not fair. It's not, it's not, it's not. Then how do I start feeling? Sad. Poor me. Isn't that tragic? Aww. Okay. How long do you think before I'm crying? You know, 20, 30 minutes, maybe? How long do you think I can think that way until I'm depressed? Not long, right? And so by changing how I think, I change how I feel. We've kind of been talking about that all weekend. What are you addicted to? Figure it out. When you figure it out, you can change it. You can change how you think about it. You can change how you behave. In the seventh step, when I recognize what my character defects are, in the fifth step, and get ready in the sixth for God to take them away, in the seventh, I can start behaving differently. And for me, some of that is about changing how I think. It's about looking at life through a new pair of glasses. There's a wonderful little book that came out, I don't even remember who published it, but it's written by Chuck C., one of the old timers in AA in California, and it's called A New Pair of Glasses. And he talks about seeing the world in a different way. And that's what we're called to do. I hope for each of you at the end of this weekend, some of you are going to go home and say, oh, I love that speaker, and others are going to say, oh my God, would she never shut up. And either one is perfectly okay. Please feel free to feel either way. Because the only thing I want you to do is give some thought to who you are and where you are in your recovery. And if it's not working, ask yourself why. What do you need to do differently? I have a question.
Well, I'd be very tormented because last time I was in the retreat, I was recommended to send away for a new pair of glasses.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the meetings, somebody pointed to me that I have no right to pass these books around.
Not at meetings, because it's not OA conference-approved literature. Well, I read all kinds of things, but I don't pass them around at meetings. Right? That's the difference. It's like taking some of the raffle items off the table at the back. You know, if they're not conference-approved, we don't sell them at OA events, so we don't sell tickets on them. So, if I get back to the seventh step, what are the things that you need to do differently? You know, we get into this thing I said to you earlier, I don't do real well with the seven deadly sins because that doesn't have a lot of relation in my mind to my life. It may work really well for you, but it doesn't for me. I have to see what's working and what's not on a day-to-day basis. And I'm usually not aware of greed in the middle of it. Right? Sloth sometimes, not often, but sometimes. One of the things I had to come to own as a character defect was my fear of creativity. Shortly after I left, I got laid off, 1995. I'd done all the things we women do. I'd cleaned all the house and washed the walls and cleaned the carpets and everything was organized. So I thought, okay, what are you going to do with the rest of your life? And I was working on my master's. And in the meantime, what are you going to do? And this little voice in the back of my head, I had started reading fiction. I'd never read fiction, really. I was too busy reading psych, self-help, spiritual stuff. I started reading fiction voraciously. And this little voice said, well, you've read so many of those books, why don't you write one? And I kind of looked around and said, yeah, Ray, you're kidding, huh? I got time for that, like I got a hole in the head. And I laughed, and I left it. But the thought wouldn't go away. It kept coming back. And so finally, to prove God wrong, I sat down and in about an hour wrote, I don't know, 5 pages, 10 pages, I don't remember what the number was. See, this doesn't make any sense and it's ugly. I'm going to do my master's courses. And so over the fall, I kept having this thought to work on this stupid book and I never opened it, I never looked at it. I don't have time, leave me alone, I'm busy. First of December, I had one course left and it was a course on ethics. And so I contacted the Psych Association of Alberta and I asked them if they would send me the Canadian Code of Ethics and some explanatory brochures and pamphlets. And the woman I talked to said, let me put you on hold. I'm new here and I don't know where they are. And she came back a few minutes later and she said, you know, we don't have any in the office, but we've just sent them out to be printed. They're actually being printed in Calgary. And so I'll give you the number of the printer and you can just phone them. And I said, okay, fine. So I phoned them, and this Oriental gentleman answered the phone, and he didn't speak any English, and he gave it to a woman, and I told her what I wanted, and she kind of seemed to understand, and she took my visa number, and she said, I'll mail it to you. And I said, okay, and she said, I'll take 10 days. I said, okay. And then I thought, well, what do I do in the meantime? And God said, you could work on that book. And I went, oh, right, I got nothing else to do. I'll work on the damn book. So I worked on the book. 10 days later, I phoned. I still hadn't got it. So I phoned the printer again, and they said, she said, oh, very sorry, had a problem going in the mail today. I said, okay, fine, so I'll work on the book, right? Because I've learned you do what's in front of you. And I was really resistant. I was really fighting it the whole time. But I'll work on this book. And then it didn't come. And she said, oh, sorry, it's Christmas. We're shut down. We didn't get them printed. Call me early in January. So I phoned her back in January. Sorry, it isn't printed. I'll get on it. And there's nothing come through on my Visa card, so I don't know what the hell's going on. But I'm really angry, so I phoned the Psych Association of Alberta, and I say, what the heck gives? And it's a man who answers the phone, and he says, I really don't know what you're talking about. We have 500 copies of that right here in our office. And I said, well, your new receptionist. He said, I haven't hired a receptionist in 3 years. Besides that, we use the Queen's printer, and that's in Edmonton. I said, oh, will you send me some? He said, yeah, I'll put them in the mail today. You should have them in 3 days. Coincidentally, the book was finished in 5. Right? God works in strange and wondrous ways. So I wrote this book, and then I put it away, right, because it wasn't any good. And it truly wasn't any good. And I had an idea for another story. And I thought, nah. And so I was talking to my sponsor about that, and she said, Louise, what character defect is that? What's going on for you? Why aren't you editing and polishing, and why aren't you sending it off to New York? What's the matter? And boy, it took a long time to figure it out. But my truth is, my mother is an extraordinarily creative woman. She can paint. She can draw. She sings with the voice of an angel. She can play almost any musical instrument given. She can crochet. She can knit. She can do all kinds of things. And she does that rather than anything else. And my father called her my whole life too stupid to live. What is the likelihood that I'm going to be able to do something creative with no guarantee of pay, right? No proof that it's going to be productive or profitable. It was a huge thing. I was so afraid of being creative. Can you imagine? Isn't that dumb? But it was a huge character defect, and it was a fear that I didn't get to until I'd been in program probably 15 years. And then I started to realize I used to sew. I designed patterns. It wasn't creative. No way. I used a kit to design patterns. That doesn't count. I knit sweaters. I crocheted drapes and tablecloths and all sorts of stuff. Well, that doesn't count. I just followed the pattern. I'd had expressive outlets for creativity my whole life, but I had labeled it something different. Right? So that I wasn't like my mother, who was too stupid to breathe. What a waste, eh? What a shame. I wish I could tell you that that turned out to be a profitable enterprise, because it didn't. I did start a writing chapter in Calgary. We have 60 members. I said to some of you today, it runs on the traditions, and they don't even know they run on the traditions. When it's time for elections, they ask who's willing to do service. And we're really clear that we have limited terms, and you can only sit so many years at a time on our board, because then you've got to step off and let somebody else do the work. And we talk about how can we help you. And every single person that comes to our meetings, we bring in speakers from New York and from Los Angeles and Dallas. And we hear the same thing. This is such a warm, wonderful group. And I believe it's that way because we operate on the traditions, whether they know it or not. We'll be 5 years old in March. We've been wildly successful as a financial endeavor. And we do things like regular workshops. And we give scholarships to people who can't afford to come, who are members of our group, because we're about supporting each other. We do things like celebrating when people have successes, really quite amazing. We have had in the 5 years, we've had three people sell and get contracts from New York publishing houses because of what they've learned in our program. And I'm really proud of that group. And the thing I'm most proud about is I'm no longer on the board. I'm done. I founded it. I started it. And we have 60 members. We're one of the largest chapters of the Romance Writers of America in North America. We're 60 members. We're in the top third of groups. And we're a little bitty group that everybody said we couldn't survive. And yet we have probably 15 members who are published now, which is just extraordinary. I have made the commitment that I will take every book I've finished and I put them in a teal green binder and I put them on the shelf so I can see them, and I put the name in the spine. And pleased or not, I'm here to tell you I have 22 books up there. Yeah? And it truly is an accomplishment. I haven't sold any. I haven't even got close to selling. But they're there and I've done it. And so right now, in truth, I am trying to decide about my next step with this writing business. Is it something that's had its time? Maybe God's will for me was to start this group and not sell. I don't know. I've been really busy, really tired. I don't feel much like writing. And I haven't written anything to speak of in the last couple of years, last 18 months probably. So the question becomes for me, am I ducking my creativity, or is it something truly that I've experienced and explored and I'm ready to let go of? And I don't have an answer yet. I know that I get bored with things and I'm ready to move on and try something new. And that may be just what's happened here. Maybe just time to let go and move on. Or it may be that there's something else going on. It could be that I'm getting close to selling and yet there's part of me that's afraid of the creativity and the success. And, you know, God forbid, being a romance writer, you know, we all know what those books are like, right? I had the privilege of being interviewed on national television a couple of years ago. We were celebrating something and they invited us, myself and another woman, in from our chapter. And the gentleman who was interviewing us at the commercial break, it was so weird, like they had a green room and everything. It was so cool. And we were on the set, and he asked some questions, and they went to break, and he said, you know, since you were coming, I bought one of those books because my mother reads them all the time. And I said, oh, really? And he said, now I understand why Dad's such a happy man. And he blushed as he said it. So you're probably sitting there saying, what the heck does that have to do with the seventh step? The reason I share it with you at this stage of the program is that part of me and part of my makeup and part of my character defects was to bury that creative expression of who I am under practicality, under organization, under living in reality, used to be favorite three words of mine. And I never let that other side of me come out and be expressed because I was afraid of being like my mother. Too stupid to live. And so that may be your story. You may have a real creative element that you're afraid to let out because it's not practical, because I'm not lucky enough to ever sell. Anybody ever say that? I'm not lucky enough to, right? It's very often part of us trying to hide our light under a bushel, under a basket. So I had to learn that that whole part for me was a character defect, and it was a shortcoming, and it was denying me the full expression of who I am. I'm always reminded, I heard a multi-published New York Times author say, in our rooms when we have a conference or a meeting, writing a book is no big deal. But if you say it in a group of 30 people, your odds are you're the only one who's ever written the end on a 100,000 word book. So celebrate that completion. And she's right. That's pretty amazing. So I ask you to give some thought as you're looking at inventory and looking at the seventh step, to give some thought to what elements of yourself are you burying? What are you hiding? What are you keeping at bay through the use of food, through the problems you're having with abstinence, through the stuff that's going on in your life? Because the odds are there's something there for each of us. In one way, shape, or form, whatever it is, take a look and see if you can tap into it. Because that's part of that becoming a whole person and becoming healed. The eighth step says that we made a list of all persons we had harmed and became willing to make amends to them all. And, we go to meetings and we hear at retreats and we read in the literature the business about becoming willing and how important willingness is. And making the list. And I discovered that what was important was that I pray over the list. And nobody had ever told me that. I had my mother-in-law on my list. And the reason I wanted to make amends to my mother-in-law was because my father-in-law had Roman hands. And one time when his hands were Roman, I poured a drink over his head. And she didn't like that. Now, he's an alcoholic. And she was a codependent. And she'd get very angry at me because I wouldn't babysit my husband the way she did hers. And her belief was that he could do anything he wanted if he was drunk, because he was drunk and it didn't count. And so she was really angry at me for my actions. And I mean, pouring a drink over somebody's head is probably not the best way to go, but it was the only thing I could do at that moment in time. And I kept trying to find a circumstance to make amends to her, because our relationship was really strained and she had never forgiven me for this, and she didn't feel I had apologized or made it right, and she was really angry. And every time I tried to make amends, the phone would ring or my kids would come in or, you know, something would happen and I couldn't say the words. And so I was sitting there one night and I started to write her a letter. Now, my mother-in-law would read the front page of a letter and miss the backside. Or she'd read page 1 and 3 and miss page 2 and then jump to all kinds of conclusions about what was in it. So this idea I had to write her a letter was really ridiculous, right? I mean, I was just asking to be set up for another go-round. And I thought, well, this isn't going to work. And I was sitting at my desk in my office and I started to cry, and what the heck am I doing and what do I need to do? And I had spent months trying to make this amends to her. And finally it dawned on me in that small, still voice, and it said, you owe your mother an amends, not your mother-in-law. Oh. So I thought about that. What do I owe my mom an amends for? And there were a whole bunch of things. Primarily, I owed my mom amends. I didn't say this to her, but I owed her amends because I let my dad bitch about her to me. And I finally had to say to him, you know, I know that you're not happily married, but that's my mother, and I don't want to hear it anymore. I'm really sorry, but please don't tell me. I owed my mother amends for thinking she was too stupid to live. I had to find a way to see her strengths and the gifts she brings. Is she my best friend? No. Are we particularly close? No. But I had to give her the gift of being as she is with no expectations. And I had to go out and get my mothering needs met from somebody else. Because my mother's entitled to be how my mother is. That's her right. Those aren't things that you typically put into a letter or say in a phone call. But what I did do was I phoned her and said, I love you. And I said, I know I always haven't been the most respectful person in the world, and I'm sorry for that, and I'm working on it. Now, does that mean I go out for Sunday dinner with her every week? No. It does mean that I can let her be who she is without fussing. I am not suffering from the Hallmark card syndrome anymore. I do not expect her to be anything other than what she is. And I learned that from my brother, who's not in program. We were walking one day and I was about Mom. And he said, when are you going to get that she's the most self-centered person in the world? What? He said, she's only interested in what interests her. You just have to quit fussing, Louise. That's how she is. And the light bulb went on. Click. Oh, I know those symptoms. How did I miss it? Yeah, that's my mother. And so if we deal together in that way, we're fine. So I go out and I get her and I take her out to lunch. She's a widow. Her and my dad separated and divorced, and then he died. So I go out and get her and go out for lunch, and I manage the time, right? About 2 hours. We hit Walmart or the grocery store and lunch. And then I take her home. Because then I can't stand listening anymore. Right? And I can be attentive and kind and I can share, but I only have to do so much. I can phone her, but I keep it very brief. Right? I've asked her not to phone me at work, because she will phone me every day to talk about the neighbor down the hall. Right? I don't have time. I put limits and I put boundaries around our relationship and I manage it. But I started to learn to do that when I put her on my amends list. That was the beginning of learning to do that. Now, in a perfect world, my mother and I would be really, really close. And we would have a wonderful relationship. But that's not my story. If you're dealing with family members who are not healthy, who are not well, who are abusing chemicals, who are violent, who are ugly, who are aggressive, what are you trying to accomplish? You know, honor thy father and mother. I agree. Sometimes I honor my mother by staying away. And part of what I've learned is just as I have the right to do that with my mother, my daughter has the right to do that with me. So be it. How many times have you gone to a family event feeling serene and full and wonderful and come out angry and agitated and wanting to eat? Huh? I hear it at meetings all the time. Why do you keep going there? Well, it's Mom and Dad. I have to go for Easter, Christmas, Canada Day, Valentine's Day, the 4th of July. Why?
You're always looking
out
for more, just hoping.
Just hoping. It's expected, yeah. The problem is our hopes get dashed. And what do we do when our hopes get dashed? We sit down to the table and we pick up a shovel. That's what we do. So why would you keep doing that? You know, if every time I walk down a particular street somebody hit me, I'd probably quit walking down the street. And you know, have you heard the autobiography in 5 short chapters? Yes. Right? You know, I was walking down the street, there was a hole, I fell in, it wasn't my fault. Chapter 2, I was walking down the same street, there was a hole, I fell in, I got out right away. Chapter 3, there was a hole, I saw it, I was walking down the street, I saw the hole, I fell in, I jumped right out. Chapter 4, I was walking down the street, I saw a hole, I walked around it. Chapter 5, I took a different street. Hello, take a different street. We keep going to the same people to nourish us. And often they don't. One of my character defects is living in fantasy. And I truly can't have a good relationship with my mother when I want her to be other than she is. So my amends to her were to let her be as she is, and to make sure I didn't let her make me crazy. Because I know she wouldn't want that. And I know in her way she loves me. But her way doesn't fill me. And I need to recognize that. It's not that she's bad or evil or wrong. I just need to recognize that. Because I can get those needs met elsewhere. I have a wonderful woman in my life. She's 78, flies all over the world. She goes to New Zealand every year or Dublin every year. She drives her car all over and she volunteers 2 nights a week and 1 day a week, and she's the president of her condo board. And she's just a dynamo. Got 14 kids, I think she has, or something. And God knows how many grandkids. And bless her heart, she loves me just the way I am. Right? We have lunch quite regularly, and we email each other, and we keep in touch. And I love her to bits. She shows me how to age. She appreciates me, she respects me, and she takes me as I am. And she's not averse to saying, you know, Louise, you might want to think about that. But she's a wise woman, and I'm truly honored to have her in my life. Is she my mom? No. Is she a mentor? A support peer? Is she a good woman to hang out with? Yeah, absolutely. And I'm so privileged to be a part of her circle and to have her part of mine. It's a gift. And so in making amends to my mom, I had to learn to put her on the list, first of all. I had to pray about the list. Because when things weren't working out so I could make amends to my mother-in-law, I had to figure out why. I had to pray about that. I had to take direction. And when I did that, I knew my mom had to be on there, and then I had to start making amends to her. The ninth step says we made direct amends to such people wherever possible, except when to do so would injure them or others. I got to tell you, there's nothing that makes me madder than people in the program who apologize and then turn around and do the same damn thing over again. You all know people like that? I sure do. I've had a few of them in my life. And I've just decided that if that's the way you are, we all make mistakes. I get that. I'm so far from perfect, that's fine. But when you repeatedly do the same things, that says to me the apology is just words. And then I get to decide whether I put a boundary that includes you or doesn't include you around me. If you keep doing things, standing me up, and, you know, I have a girlfriend that would repeatedly stand me up. The woman I did service with, she was forever losing her temper and yelling and screaming and being almost paranoid. And then, oh, I'm sorry. Well, I'm sorry too. But at some point in time, I stopped being in the company of people like that. Because I quit hoping that they're going to change. How many of you have spent time in your life hoping that somebody will change? Raise your hand. Yeah. Oh, good. Mostly everybody in the room. I'm in the right room. Right. And when they don't, what do? We eat. Or we beat ourselves up. It's our fault. We've done something wrong. If we were smarter or better or whatever, whatever your tape says, they'd love us. I was saying last night, you know, my ex-husband is a good man. He's an alcoholic. He has a gambling addiction. He's a decent human being, as much as he can be with those two addictions. But for 30 years, I kept saying, what's wrong with me that he's not enough? What's wrong with me if I could just accept him? And I came to understand that the best amends I could make to him and to me was to end the marriage. Because we were never going to be alike enough to be truly comfortable. My son said after we were separated about 3 years, my son always thought that I was the wicked witch, right? I was the one that held things to consequences and accountability, and his dad didn't. And so when I moved out, our son moved back in, and he didn't work for 3 years. He just lived with his dad and drove dad's new truck and had dad's Visa card and had a good time and drank and partied and wasn't life good. And I would never let him do that when he lived with me, so he was never real happy with his mom. Anyway, his dad sold the house that they were living in and moved in with the new girlfriend, and my son had to find a place to live, and he took the two family dogs who were quite elderly. And in that process of being forced to take responsibility, my son became responsible. And it's a reality, and when I look at who he is today, the man he's become, it brings me to tears every time I think about it, because he's the kid I despaired of ever finding his way in life. Goes to show what I know, right? Anyways, he came to me and he said, I need you to put your shrink hat on for a minute and talk to me and explain something. And I said, okay, I'll try. And he said, I don't mean to hurt your feelings, but when you and Dad separated, he said repeatedly, and I agreed with him, that what he was glad about and what he felt, why he felt the marriage had to end, because he was sick and tired of you telling him what to do. Okay. And I mean, truly, when we got married, I said, jump. He said, how high on the way up? And he better be up quick. You know, I was very dominant. But I got in here and I started working the steps and I started using the program and I stopped being so controlling. Slowly, right? I'm never going to be passive, I know that. But I worked really hard to become assertive as opposed to aggressive with him. And what happened was, the more assertive I became, and what would you like to do, the more he backed off from making decisions. Right? Because aggressive people don't hook up with aggressive people. We'd kill each other, right? You got to have a passive partner in there to make it work. And when I moved from being controlling to midline, he didn't want to come up and meet me. He became more and more passive. And so my son said, I don't understand. He was so unhappy because you were so bossy. And I said, well, I know he thought that. I think I changed. He never saw that. And he said, well, then why is he hooked up with a woman who makes you look like an amateur when it comes to telling him what to do? Because he didn't do his work. Think of a puzzle. My grandchildren do puzzles, and my grandson does these great big pieces on his puzzles, you know, 8 pieces, and they're about 4 inches high. So I want you to think about a jigsaw puzzle with 2 pieces. Square edges around the outside, 2 pieces, and they fit together. Okay? That big piece, you know how puzzles have a piece that sticks out? Can only fit into a piece that's got the hole. That's how they interlock. And that's how we are in relationships, in my opinion. We find our mate. What happens if you start to change the shape of that puzzle piece? It doesn't fit anymore. And so the pieces don't fit, and we eventually, that puzzle falls apart. In relationships, if we do our work, often the pieces don't fit anymore. And we're terrified of that. We start to change. We get abstinent. We get clean. We start working on our character defects. And then the puzzle pieces don't fit anymore, and we get scared. And so what's the logical thing to do if you're a compulsive overeater and you're scared? You eat, right? Now, not every marriage and program ends in divorce. And some of us are lucky enough to marry healthy people to begin with. Not many, but some. So if you're in a relationship and you're struggling with your food and with your peace of mind and with your sense of wholeness, is it that this puzzle isn't working anymore? Is it that you need something different? I mean, when I look at my now ex-husband and I, we were married 1 month shy of 30 years. And truly, we never fit after about our 10th anniversary. And I kept trying to make it work. I have a cartoon that's on my fridge. I've had it for years and years, and it's a Charlie Brown cartoon. And Lucy says to Charlie, how many times does 12 go into 6? And he says, it doesn't. She says, well, it will if you push. Story of my life. It will if you push. So I had to learn that one of my character defects is I push. And when I got people on my list of amends, I had to make amends. And I had to stand back and let things start to fall out. I had to start to accept that being single at 48 was okay. And truthfully, at 57, it's pretty good. You know, would I like a partner? Sure. Am I willing to give up much to get one? Probably not. Right? I'm pretty comfortable in my life. I'd like somebody to holiday with. Maybe go to a movie now and then. I miss dancing. Oh, well, you know, there's lots of other benefits I get from my lifestyle and space right now. Does that mean if some good-looking hunk knocked on my door tomorrow, I'd send him away? Probably not. But I'm also really clear that I'm not hanging out in the bars and the internet chat rooms to meet him either. And my prayer is, God, if you need me to have someone in my life, I trust you to bring him into my orb. I thought with this job maybe there'd be some good-looking rich doctor, but apparently not. I work exclusively with women. I kind of like women. I work only with women. It's really funny. There's one man in our building, and he's, I think, 28 or something. So happily married. So much for that. So step 7, 8, and 9, we ask God to remove our shortcomings, and we have to become aware of what they are. And it's not just things like sloth and greed and envy for me. It's bigger than that. So I encourage you to think kind of outside of the box when you're looking at your inventory, when you're sharing, when you're doing your 6th and 7th steps. Get beyond just the obvious sins, if you will. Think about from a psychological standpoint, from a therapy standpoint, from a spiritual standpoint, from a physical standpoint, what's not working? You know what's not working. I'll bet each and every one of you could write 2 or 3 things down right now that you're doing that doesn't work. It's a pattern, it's a habit, but it's not working. Step 8, you make the list. Be sure to pray about it. It's okay to pray for willingness. When you put people on the list, I always found there's kind of, I think I was told there are 3 three kind of categories. People I'll make amends to today, people I'm willing to pray for willingness to make amends to, and then there's the others that they'll get it when hell freezes over. Right? And that's okay too. Because when you get the easy ones done at the first two categories, the when hell freezes over group moves up to the top and you get to do that. It's funny how that works. It just seems to happen. So don't worry about that. It will come, even if you're not willing to make amends to those people in the immediate short term. The promises are here, and they come after step 9. And they're always significant. They kept me going at many times when my life was hard and when I was facing challenges. And if you're having a hard time, I encourage you to read these promises, write them out, journal about them, pray about them, meditate on them, because they are truly, truly amazing, and they happen if we work for them. And so on page 83, it says, if we are painstaking about this phase of our development, we will be amazed before we are halfway through. We are going to know a new freedom and a new happiness. Did you hear the words new? Not the same old, a new freedom and a new happiness. We will not regret the past nor wish to shut the door on it. We will comprehend the word serenity and we will know peace. No matter how far down the scale we have gone, we will see how our experience can benefit others. That feeling of uselessness and self-pity will disappear. We will lose interest in selfish things and gain interest in our fellows. Self-seeking will slip away. Our whole attitude and outlook on life will change. Fear of people and of economic insecurity will leave us. We will intuitively know how to handle situations which used to baffle us. And we will suddenly realize that God is doing for us what we could not do for ourselves. Isn't that powerful? What an incredible piece of writing. And I read it lots. I have it printed on an index card. I have it in my handbag. Not this one, but the one at home. I have it in, I use it as a bookmark. I keep it by my bed. It's a wonderful quick 10th step, right? Am I having happiness? Am I having joy? Am I having freedom? It works really well for me, and it comes as a result of doing the 9th step. And for me, it started to come true before I had completed all of my amends, but it was there. I'm right on time. That's so cool. I wanted to say to you before, I know some of you are going home tonight, you won't be back tomorrow. And so I wanted to say goodnight, and I wanted to thank you for coming. My email address is all over the net. Feel free, if you've got questions about anything I've said or you disagree with anything I've said, email me. I always read email and I always respond as quickly as I can. Right now you can use R, just the letter R, and a number 1 trustee at shaw.ca. And if you've got stuff you want to talk over, or you want some whatever, you want to say, geez, I think you were a fruitcake, what were you smoking that weekend? That's okay too. The good point is that my path doesn't have to be your path. It's just my path. Okay, let's stand and say the serenity prayer. And then we'll take a break, and then we'll come back and talk about body image.